96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at wslr.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. As the Arctic ice melts and extreme weather events become commonplace, it's now abundantly clear that we need to stop burning fossil fuels. The price of solar and wind has been dropping, leading to a burst of optimism about decarbonization. But all those electric cars need batteries. Factories building all those solar panels and wind turbines need resources, and those resources come with a cost. Vince Beiser traveled all over the world to see where minerals like lithium, copper, cobalt, and other resources are being mined and refined. In his book, Power Metals, The Race for the Resources That Will Shape the Future, he shows how clean energy comes with a steep price that isn't evenly distributed. Vince, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks for having me on, Marianne. Great to be here.
What are rare earth metals and what are they used for?
So what are rare earths? It's a really good question. And a lot of people get confused because there are a lot of different metals that we need for the energy transition to build all of our electric cars and so on. They're usually grouped sort of in a big basket called critical metals. Rare earths are a subset. They're one group of metals on that list of critical metals. So what rare earths are specifically is they're 17 really weird, obscure metals with names like neodymium and praseodymium, yttrium, and they're absolutely necessary for the motors that make your electric car go forward. They're crucial parts of wind turbines. They're also needed for a whole range of hyper-specific but incredibly important functions like the screen that we're talking over right now, the reason that we can see the color red in it is because there's a little tiny bit of rare earth called europium in there that makes the color red. Don't ask me to explain how because I don't understand how, but bottom line, no europium, no red in your screen. They're these really niche metals that without which really modern life couldn't carry on.
Where are these rare earth and the essential metals found?
We get them from many different places. The biggest source of lithium in the world is in South America, in a region of northern Chile and Argentina. Rare earths, a lot of those come from China. Cobalt, 70% of all the cobalt that we need in this world, which is an ingredient in the batteries in everything from your cell phone to an electric vehicle, they all have cobalt in them. 70% of that cobalt comes from one country, the Democratic Republic of Congo. So this is one of the big problems of this era that we're entering into of renewable energy and digital technology is that it really depends on all these technologies depend on metals, and many of these metals come from only a very small number of places, which can be a problem.
And most of the refining for this is taking place now in China. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How did that happen?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. We dig up these metals all over the world, and by we, I mean the human race. But no matter where they come out of the ground, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in the United States, whether it's here in Canada where I live, almost all of them go to China for refining and processing to be turned into pure metal. And the reason for that is basically because the United States, which used to be the world's preeminent mining and metal producing country, we basically decided we didn't want the mess that comes with it. We wanted to get out of the dirty business of extracting and manufacturing these metals, really because they're really hard on the environment. These are really dirty, destructive, polluting industries. Nobody wants them in their backyard. And so basically, as the environmental movement got into gear in the 1970s, 1980s, stronger environmental regulations kicked in. More and more communities got together and said, no, we don't want a copper smelter in our backyard. China, which was just then opening up to the world, said, well, we'll take it. We'll open up those refineries and those factories and those mines. Send that business our way. So we did, on the theory that, you know what, let them create all the mess, let all the damage happen in their backyard, and we'll just buy the finished products. But what that's meant now is that we've become very vulnerable, because China now really has a stranglehold on the production of most of these metals that we're talking about.
There was an incident with China and Japan, and it illustrates how the geopolitical balance is being changed by China's predominance in these metals.
Absolutely. This was back in 2010, and it was kind of the first warning shot that made the Western world sit up and realize, holy smokes, we've lost control of an essential industry here. Basically, what happened was China and Japan got into a territorial dispute over some, there are these islands that both of them claim, and they're squabbling over them for years. Tensions ratcheted up, and China said, you know what, Japan, we're going to cut off all rare earth exports to you. And they did. Now, Japan needs rare earths for their electronics industry, for their car industry. So they absolutely panicked. And in fact, there were shockwaves throughout the world. All of a sudden, the world woke up and realized that China has this stranglehold on a really crucial supply chain that's crucial to the whole entire world. So that situation calmed down pretty quick, but it alerted us to this vulnerability that we have. But I'll tell you, we still haven't really recovered from that lesson. Only just this past year, when President Trump slapped his trade tariffs on China, right? Remember that at the beginning of the year? And he said, okay, China, 100% tariffs on everything you said. Well, China did the exact same thing. And they said, fine, no more rare earths for you. Car production lines in the Midwest shut down. Tech executives all over the world were freaking out. And the U.S. basically had to back down, because no rare earths, no electric vehicles, no digital technology. They've really got us over a barrel.
That's bad enough. But let's talk a little bit about what the mining of some of these metals looks like, because there's a lot of child labor involved, and the amount of pollution is really tremendous.
Mining is one of the dirtiest and most destructive industries around. If you think about it, the whole point of mining is to destroy the earth. It's to rip up topsoil, cut down whatever plant life, animal habitat is in the way, dig down into the earth, dig a big, huge pit, blast out any rock that's in your way, claw out the rock and the ore with gigantic machinery, and then crush it down. The whole point is to inflict damage on the earth to get things that we need. But there are huge costs that come with that. So first of all, the energy that's produced, mining produces an enormous amount of carbon emissions. It's one of the biggest contributors to carbon emissions on the planet, because of all that heavy machinery that's involved, all the trucks carrying ore back and forth, all of that. And yeah, as you mentioned, in a lot of places, it's even worse than that. There's other terrible consequences that come with it. In Indonesia, for instance, which is the world's biggest source of nickel, which is another battery ingredient, hundreds of miles of rainforest have been bulldozed to the ground to get at the nickel that's underground. In Congo, which I mentioned before, is where we get 70% of our cobalt. Just like you said, there are children working in a lot of those mines. Little kids we're talking about, as young as 6 or 7. In many different places, you have all kinds of terrible environmental harm that's being caused. Rivers being poisoned, all the water being sucked out of dry lands to be used in mines. There are big, big costs to this so-called clean energy revolution. Now, that said, I don't want anybody listening to this to think that means that the renewable energy and electric cars are terrible. No, we need those things, because the biggest threat that we face, the biggest environmental harm that we face, is climate change. We've got to switch off of fossil fuels and onto renewables. But we have to understand That's not a painless, it's not a free transition. It comes with enormous costs. And the challenge for us is how to figure out how to keep those costs to a minimum, how to do as little damage as possible.
How about recycling? How effective is that going to be in this whole equation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So recycling is important, for sure. We do a certain amount of recycling of these metals that we're talking about already. We could be doing more. We should be doing much more. But recycling is not a solution all in and of itself for a few reasons. But mainly, it turns out, and this is one of the most eye-opening things for me that I learned while I was researching the book, it turns out that recycling is also very energy intensive, uses a lot of energy, which means carbon emissions. It's very polluting, creates lots of pollution on its own. And it's often done on the backs of the poorest people on Earth, like the people who are actually sifting through all of our trash and separating it out and doing the work of making it recyclable, especially when we're talking about metals, especially when we're talking about all of our digital gadgets, you know, our phones and our laptops and all that stuff. That's often done by really, literally some of the poorest people on Earth.
And you actually travel to some of these places and talk to the people who are doing this work.
Yeah, one of the places I went to was Lagos, Nigeria. It's the biggest city in Africa. And it was fascinating and kind of horrifying because what I learned was when you drop off your old cell phone or your old laptop, whatever it is, your old iPad, your old Roomba, you toss it in a recycling bin at Best Buy or wherever, it is almost certainly not going to be recycled in the U.S. What's going to happen is it's going to get put on a truck, driven out to a port somewhere, loaded onto a container ship where it's going to be sent off across the ocean somewhere, burning diesel the whole way, and it's going to end up somewhere like Lagos.
Why is that? Why are we not doing any of the recycling in the United States?
It's expensive. It's difficult to make much money at it if you're paying people American wages and doing things to American environmental standards. Just razor thin profit margins in the recycling business. And very few people in the U.S., really very few people are even trying.
Okay, and so this gets put on a ship and
diesels its way across the ocean, billowing out smoke the whole way. And it winds up somewhere like the slums of Lagos, where I went to, where there are thousands of people sitting around all day, every day, with hammers and screwdrivers, cracking open old cell phones like walnuts and pulling out the little bits of recyclable metal that are inside of them. All of our gadgets have small amounts of metal, but you pile up enough of it, it's worth a lot of money. It's very labor intensive. It's really quite something to see, you know, these super high tech devices just literally getting smashed open with hammers in the crudest, most medieval methods. But on one level, this is a good thing. This is actually recycling. These are things that would have wound up in a garbage dump otherwise. The metal's being pulled out and it is being resold and it will be used again. And by the way, it creates thousands of jobs, which is really important in a place like Nigeria. So that's all to the good. But as always, there's a cost. There's a downside to it too. And that comes mainly in what happens to the rest of the stuff. After they've pulled out the little bits of valuable metals, what happens to the plastic and the cables and all the other bits and pieces? A lot of that stuff gets burned, just like torched in these giant open air fires that are just billowing out the most rancid, reeking, toxic smoke you can imagine that's being breathed in by everybody who's nearby. And this is all being done, by the way, by people who have zero safety equipment, no masks, no boots, no gloves, no goggles. It's literally guys in flip-flops and t-shirts just doing this all day long, every day, for years.
And this is because this is the only way that it makes sense financially.
It's not the only way, but it's one way. There's a whole spectrum in the world of recycling. There are industrial facilities in Europe and in China that can relatively cleanly take old cell phones and melt them down and chemically separate out the metal. That does happen, but there's also demand for this stuff overseas in these kind of unregulated, kind of gray market businesses.
host blood centers depend on local blood donors. They are especially in need of donors during the holidays, when blood donations typically drop, while the need remains constant. Suncoast Blood Centers is a local nonprofit providing safe, high-quality blood products to hospitals and patients across Southwest Florida since 1949. More information, including donation locations, is available at suncoastblood.org. You're listening to the Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Vince Beiser, and we're talking about his book, Power Metal: The Race for the Resources That Will Shape the Future. One of the metals you write about is copper, and you write, with the possible exception of gold, no other metal has caused as much death and destruction. Copper?
Copper, yeah. Sad to say. Yep, that familiar metal that you might be wearing in jewelry or that's on the bottom of your pots and pans or whatever. Yeah, well, so first of all, up until about 100 years ago, the United States produced most of the world's copper. We were a huge mining power. And to get that copper, we just destroyed, just ravaged huge swaths of the American West, of places like Montana, Utah, Arizona, poisoning streams, ripping up land, fouling the air with pollution from the smelters. I mean, you can imagine 100 years ago, the kind of smokestack industries and the kind of poison that was pouring out of them with nobody paying any attention to it. Even though a lot of those mines have now been shut down, still today about half the rivers in the western part of the U.S. still have toxins from the mostly from copper mining back in those days. And most of the biggest Superfund sites, like the most polluted places in all the United States, are old copper mining sites where they've still got ponds that are full of industrial runoff that's so toxic that birds landing in it die, rivers that where there's still no fish. So yeah, getting all that copper causes a lot of trouble. And then fast forward to today. So copper is really, it's the metal that we need the most of for the energy transition. And the reason for that is it's how we transport electricity. So we've got solar power, you got wind power, great. But how do you get that energy, that electricity from your solar farm or your wind farm to your house? It's carried on copper cables, power cables. It's all copper, thousands and thousands of miles of copper. So all around the world, demand for copper is just exploding. The price is going way, way up. And that means whenever there's a lot of money to be made like that in a hurry, the black market comes in, criminals come in, people looking for a fast buck. So copper theft has just skyrocketed in the U.S., all over the world. People are being killed over it. In places like South Africa, you have organized gangs of copper thieves that are going around ripping up power cables out of the ground and shooting anybody who gets in their way.
One of the other solutions that keeps getting put out there is deep sea mining. Apparently, there's a trove of these kinds of materials in the sea. Why aren't we doing that?
Well, a lot of people really think we should and are pushing very hard for it, or at least a small number of very well-financed people are pushing very hard for us to start mining the bottom of the ocean floor. Nutshell is, yes, indeed, at the very bottom of the ocean, on the floor of the Pacific, 4 miles underwater, there are huge amounts of rocks, basically little rocks that are full of copper, nickel, many of the metals that we need, billions and billions of dollars worth if we can get them up. Problem is, to get them up, you literally have to strip mine the bottom of the ocean. You know, there are several companies and other folks who are really pushing to be allowed to do this because of all the money to be made. But pretty much every marine scientist that I spoke to, hundreds more that have spoken up around the world, all say, in doing this, we might cause incalculable harm to the oceans. We don't even know what lives down at the bottom of the ocean. We've just barely begun to explore it. We don't even know the damage that we would do down there and what species we would destroy, and then what species live off of those species and what species live off of those species, and you go all the way up. We just have no idea what kind of harm it might do to the oceans. And if we destroy the oceans, we're all dead. I mean, the oceans are the source of much of our food, much of our oxygen. The oceans are already seriously stressed from climate change, from overfishing, from pollution, from all the stresses that we human beings put on them. So there's a big, big fear that if we add one more big punch to the oceans, who knows what's going to happen. So where it stands is right now, under international law, there's a UN agency that has the power to say green light or red light, yes or no to undersea mining. And so far they have said no. They've said we need to do more research to understand what the risks are before we allow it to happen. That was the case right up until last year. Nobody was allowing it to go ahead. And then President Trump came in and basically said, you know what? I think we, the United States, have the authority to say, forget the United Nations, maybe we'll just allow it to happen. So it hasn't started yet, but basically the U.S. might just unilaterally, all on their own hook, give the green light to some of these companies that want to start digging up the ocean floor.
And this could potentially start a catastrophic chain of events. It seems like we keep running into, and this might end all life on the planet, kind of narratives. How should we be changing our way of life to reflect these realities? I mean, we keep getting sold this idea that we'll just substitute other stuff and everything's going to be hunky-dory. But it doesn't seem like that's the way this story ends.
Yeah, no, I really don't think so. It's sort of a myth of the energy revolution, the idea that if everybody switched to electric vehicles, we'll be fine. But really, there's about 1.2 billion cars on the road worldwide. And if we swap all of those for electric cars, we're just going to swap one set of problems for another. Listen, electric vehicles, much better than gas-powered vehicles, for sure. But if you ask me, the number one thing that we can do, the most important tool in our tool belt, is to think about having fewer cars, period. So what I always tell people is if you as an individual, you really want to make a difference, the best thing you can do, if it's possible for you, don't buy a car, not even an electric one. We need to find ways to build our cities and to live our lives in ways that don't require you to own a car. Cars aren't bad in and of themselves. Right? I mean, I own a car too. Right? Most people do. The problem is the number of them. There's so many, they consume so much resources, so much energy. And of course, more and more people all over the world want them. And that's just not possible. It's not possible to have a world of 8 billion people where every family owns two cars the way that they do here in the United States. So much better if we can figure out ways to give people the choice to own a car. Because the problem right now is most places in North America, you don't have a choice. You can't get around unless you have a car. But if we could design our cities and change our habits such that you could get around by subways, by public transit, by bicycles, by electric bicycles, on foot, in ways where you have the choice of whether or not to own a car, then we have a world where we don't need nearly as many cars. And then that's a world where we're putting much less pressure on the planet, much more sustainable.
But the problem is we're not seeing the full cost. I live in a suburb, and I started thinking about this after reading the book. It's like, would be really nice if I could get rid of my car. And then I started thinking about riding a bicycle on some of the roads that have no sidewalks. They don't really have a shoulder. This requires a whole different way of looking at how we are in the world. And as long as the costs are hidden, there's no incentive to have this happen. When are we going to start seeing the real cost of this coming home to roost?
I think the best way to do it is to force people to pay those costs. For instance, think about smoking. When I was a kid, everybody smoked. People smoked all the time, everywhere. And yeah, everybody kind of knew, oh, it's bad for you. But still, tons of people smoke. What's really cut down on smoking, one thing is public awareness. But I think the most important thing is governments just started taxing the hell out of cigarettes to pay for all the healthcare costs that come with them. Basically, they said, look, all you smokers, you're putting a huge burden on the healthcare system. We're going to add a buck a pack tax on cigarettes to help pay for that. If you're a pack a day smoker and the cost of your cigarettes keeps going up and up and up and up, that more than anything else is going to encourage you to cut down on smoking. I feel like we need to do a similar thing with consumption across the board. Right now, we're not paying the costs. We pay the price of a thing. You pay the price of your new iPad or your electric car or whatever it is, but you are not paying for that destroyed rainforest in Indonesia. You are not paying for the poisoned river in northern Canada that helped produce it. Somebody else is, but not you. But if so, those outside costs were added on, you would start to think twice about whether or not you need a brand new iPhone every year. Maybe you only need a new iPhone every 2 years or 3 years.
But we can't even get policies passed in this country to help subsidize health care costs for fellow Americans. Having people pay for the cost of children working in mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo seems at this point so remote.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, nobody's going to do it voluntarily, that's for sure. It's got to be governments basically coming in and one way or another, whether it's through taxes, whether it's through forcing corporations to cover the costs themselves, it's got to happen. But here's the thing. It's not that crazy of an idea. These are ideas that we already live with. I don't know about where you live, but in most places, when you buy a can of beer or a bottle of beer from the store, you pay an extra 5 cents or 10 cents for that bottle. You may not even notice it, but that cost is there. Anybody can get that can and take it back to the store and get that nickel back. It's an extra cost that's added in to promote recycling. And it works really well because that's why you see homeless folks rummaging through the trash, pulling out bottles and cans because they can make a little money out of it. And basically, you are paying for that. You paid that extra dime for that bottle. Somebody else is collecting that dime. But the point is, by adding in that extra cost, you create a mechanism that promotes recycling. There are ways that we could do that with lots more things, with all of our gadgets, with our cars. Or another way we can do it is to tell companies to pass laws saying, if you manufacture toasters, you are responsible for making sure all those toasters get recycled. And that can mean that you, Westinghouse or General Electric or whatever, you're probably not going to run around collecting old toasters, but you got to kick in some money to the local city fund that runs the recycling center. And that's exactly how it works here in Vancouver, where I live.
And what about the idea of making things repairable?
Mm-hmm. Glad you brought that up. Yes, that's also a great idea. And you know, I talk about this in the book. One of the big problems with making our things last longer, our electronic gadgets, is they're really hard to fix. And that is not by accident. That is a deliberate corporate strategy. They make things hard to fix. They make it hard to get spare parts. They make it hard to get the manuals that you need so that you'll have an incentive to just buy a new one. And this has been going on for years and years and years. And it's a huge problem. The good news is there's, as I write about in the book, there's this movement called the Right to Repair movement, basically all across the US and lots of other places in the world. There's activists working to get states, cities, national governments to pass laws to force corporations to make their stuff easier to repair. And the amazing good news is in just in the last 2-3 years, they've had big successes in a whole bunch of places in California, New York, Oregon. About 6-7 states have passed right to repair laws just in the last couple of years.
Well, that's so good news.
Yeah, there we go. A
little bit of upbeat. You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Vince Beiser, and we've been talking about his book, Power Metal.
Power Metal.
Thanks again. It's been great talking with you.
Sure. Well, it's been a pleasure.
His book, Power Metal.
Power Metal.
Thanks again. It's been great talking with you.
Sure. Well, it's been a pleasure.